This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. The Rwandan genocide began 25 years ago this month. Over just 100 days, about 800,000 people, many of them Tutsis, were killed by Hutu extremists. But just a month before the genocide began, Tutsi Eric Morongwe wasn't afraid, even though people on the street were calling him names like cockroach. Eric was an invincible 19-year-old, a star athlete at the peak of his career as the goalkeeper for Rwanda's most beloved football team, Rayon Sport. And he says he was more concerned about the game than what was going on beyond the football field. Reporter Shayna Sheely traveled to Rwanda to gather this story.
It was spring of 1994. Eric Morongwe was training for the game of a lifetime, a qualifying match for the Africa World Cup against a skilled team from Sudan called Al Hilal. Rayon had the chance to put Rwanda on the international football map. As he and his teammates made their way into Kigali by bus, Eric put on his headphones. Country music helped calm his nerves before big games. On a train bound for nowhere. And he gazed out the window. What he saw was frightening.
Tires been burned up, trees been brought in the middle of the road.
And as the team approached the city, men in military clothing stopped the bus and asked Eric and his teammates to step outside. Eric was one of only three Tutsis on his football team, one of three Tutsis on the bus.
Could easily tell who was a Hutu and who was a Tutsi.
But there was something else the soldiers could recognize.
Most goalkeepers in this country wore long black pants, but I came up with a different style by wearing shorts, colorful top, and I've always also put on my hat.
The soldiers immediately recognized Eric in his cap and colorful outfit, not as a Tutsi, but as the Rayon Sport goalkeeper, who they called Toto. They were huge football fans. They shook Eric's sweaty hand and wished him luck in the game against Al Hilal. And they waved the bus on its way. When they finally got to the stadium for the big game, it seemed like everyone in the entire country was there. Guys in jeans and t-shirts sat next to men in military uniforms. Everyone in the crowd was cheering and singing together.
When we scored the fourth goal, I knew that was almost impossible for the other team to come back, and I could see how that meant to the 30,000+ people who were in the stadium. It was really huge.
Huge because of the win. And huge because at that moment, Rayon fans weren't celebrating as Tutsi or Hutu. They were celebrating together. After the game, Eric remembers that every pub was packed. Strangers handed him big money, bought him beers. Guys at checkpoints wrapped blue and white plastic trash bags, Rayon Sport's colors, around the barrels of their AK-47s and waved them in the air.
I mean, people walking on the street, some of them militias who you would usually be throwing insults and bad words, they were just cheering on. The win of Rayon Sport became a moment of uniting Rwandans once again.
That feeling was fleeting, though. Just 1 month later, the genocide against the Tutsis began.
April 6th. It was a normal day. I had a very busy afternoon.
Eric got home late that night, took a shower, and went straight to bed.
By 3, 4 a.m., I was woken up by incredible sounds of machine guns. And it went on and on, on and on and on.
Eric and his roommate crawled on the floor to get to the windows. they saw smoke in the air and flashes of gunfire as organized gangs of Hutu militias swept through their neighborhood with machetes and guns.
Within a minute, our home was swamped by a group of soldiers, about 5-6 of them. They came in, kicked the compound gate in, and then they came and banged on our door. We opened. As soon as we opened, they slapped us, asked us to lie on the floor.
They slapped your faces?
Yeah.
The group of men said they were there to look for hidden weapons. Eric tried to convince them he and his roommates were just football players.
But they were not listening. They were clearly ready to kill us.
The men pulled food from the cabinets and threw it on the floor. They broke dishes, kicked chairs over.
One of the things that they threw up and down happened to be a photo album. It just landed on the floor wide open, and it caught the attention of one of the soldiers.
The photo album had landed open to a page of Eric and his teammates at the Rwandan president's house. One of the men turned to Eric and said, "Who are these people?"
And I said, "They're my teammates." "What do you mean they are your teammates?" I said, "I play for Rayon Sport." And he just turned and say, "Why are you trying to lie to me?" And then he picked the album and looked at the photos, and then he turned to me where I was lying down on the floor. He said, "Are you Toto?" And I say, "Yes, I am."
The guy asked Eric to get up off the floor and ordered the other men to leave the room. He told Eric to sit on the couch. And for 5 long minutes, he sat next to Eric, talking about the game between Al Hilal and Rayon Sport.
He just wanted to talk about the game. He was so proud that we won. To be honest, my mind was no longer working in a normal way. You just don't know how to conduct yourself, how to look, how to behave. You're just there. You're in a state of mind that you can't be able to control.
The guy went on to give Eric tips to open the curtains wide and leave the gate open to make the house look empty.
And it seemed to work because no one else came into our house for the next 2-3 hours.
That night, when the sounds of gunfire faded, Eric was overcome with a desire to be with his teammates. So early the next morning, he walked a few blocks over to a big house where most of his teammates lived. Most people there were Hutu, so they had to show solidarity with the Hutu militia taking over the neighborhood. They'd leave in shifts to monitor checkpoints nearby, each time coming home with new news about what was happening outside.
In some cases, they even saw some individuals being executed right in front, in their eyes. They saw bodies of the people they knew lying on the street.
Even though people were being slaughtered by the hundreds outside, Eric says that inside the house, it felt sort of like old times. The teammates played cards and watched TV to pass time.
My teammate's house became my place. It was a big risk. It was a big risk. They could easily been killed. But it didn't seem to be a big issue to them, especially one of them, a guy called Longe. He basically did everything.
Longe was a Hutu teammate. One night, at a neighborhood checkpoint, Longe heard a guy spreading rumors that Eric was an agent, that he was hiding a secret gun. So when Longe got home the next morning, he told Eric that they'd need to find a new place for him to stay. It was too risky at the team house. Longe and Eric left immediately and started walking aimlessly until Longe came up with an idea to go to Zuzu's house. Zuzu was one of Rayon Sport's biggest fans.
We knew each other very well. We had a relationship. He as a fan and I as a player for the club.
Zuzu was also a top guy in the Hutu militia. Eric thought Longe was out of his mind.
How could I go and seek refuge to someone who we all know that he's actually part of the killing machine?
But he didn't have much choice. So Eric and Longe went to Zuzu's house. Eric knocked on the door.
He came out smiling and joking, saying that he was happy to see me alive.
Eric remembers Zuzu's reasoning for wanting to save him, so that when the genocide was over, Eric would still be around to save goals for Rayon Sport.
He just said, you know, feel free to stay. And he told his people there to look after me.
For the next few days, Zuzu left home early and came home late.
As if he was going to a normal day life. What kind of business was he up to at that particular time when nothing else other than killing and fighting and rooting was happening? You can make your own judgment on that.
Lanjie visited regularly to give Eric updates. When Zuzu came back at night, he and Eric would eat dinner, play cards, and talk football.
It was just a very weird and uncomfortable situation to be in.
Eric sort of lost track of time, but he thinks he was at Zuzu's for about a week until Zuzu's neighbors got suspicious. They knew Eric was hiding in the house. So once again, early in the morning, Eric made his way on foot back to his teammate's house. After he got there, he thought he'd be safer if he could get a travel permit. So he went to a local leader, an old friend. But when he got there, he once again found himself face to face with soldiers.
The one who had the gun just stepped back and charged his gun and shot.
The bullet grazed the sleeve of his shirt, leaving a hole in it. Another soldier hit Eric over the head with what he thinks might have been a hammer.
All of a sudden, I saw blood dripping down my shoulder. And I thought that was the moment. That was it. I was going to be killed.
But again, Eric was saved by football. A group of older men, football fans, recognized the Rayon Sport goalkeeper, and they shouted,
"Run!" So we started running.
When he got back to his teammate's house, Lanjie was there, and suggested the next move.
That I had to go back to Zuzu's place.
I knew what side Zuzu was on, but I didn't have any other choice.
By now, the situation had become much more extreme. Hundreds of thousands of Tutsis had been killed. But despite rising tensions, Zuzu opened the door for Eric a second time. Eric stayed there for a few days. He heard on the radio that the International Red Cross building had become sort of a safe haven, and so he asked Zuzu if he would take him there. Zuzu drove Eric in his car, with an armed guard in front and another in the back.
He asked me to get out of the car. He wished me well. I was left just standing there.
Eric was safe. Zuzu had saved him. But Eric says Zuzu's not a hero.
Every person who killed people, you will also find that they saved one or two other people. So,
So you're saying that Zuzu, like, this wasn't special at all? That
Oh yes. Yeah, it's not unique to Zuzu. This you will find thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in Rwanda who on one hand killed, heavily involved in the killings, but also saved some individuals.
As soon as the genocide ended, Eric looked for his teammates who had survived. He found enough to form a small team, and even though they were in mourning, within weeks, Rayon was back together again.
Unfortunately, the two teammates who really did everything for me did not survive. Longin, yeah. So they saw him as a traitor. They killed him.
As people dug trenches for mass graves and sorted through piles of bodies, Eric and his teammates dribbled and ran and passed footballs to one another. When I visited in 2018, Eric walked me to the stadium where they played for the first few weeks. People are still kicking balls to one another here.
It's like a red dirt area, and then there's
the
field.
It is. Not, we call it tapis rouge, which means the red carpet. So.
Just 2 months after the genocide, Ransport was ready for another game. This time, against a local rival, Kiva Sport. Eric says the match against Kiva Sport was the first sort of happy public event in the country after the genocide. The only other gathering that had taken place was communal cleaning to deal with the rotting bodies.
To see 10, 15,000 people gathered gave you the life back. People were singing, were cheering, were enjoying it.
And you won the game?
Did we win the game? I can't even remember.
It didn't matter.
It didn't matter that we won or lost. I think what mattered was just to have that game played.
After the genocide, Zuzu changed his name, filed for asylum, and landed in Chicago, where he worked as a clerk at a grocery store until 2004, when someone from Kigali recognized him as one of the men behind the killing regime. He was then arrested for lying on his asylum claim papers, extradited back to Rwanda, and put in prison for life for war crimes. Eric Morongwe went on to play for Rwanda's national team and then applied for asylum and moved to the UK, where he started a nonprofit football club that teaches kids about dialogue and conflict resolution.
That's reporter Shayna Sheely. Shayna's reporting on this story was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation as part of its African Great Lakes Reporting Initiative. Eric Morongwe's organization is called Football for Hope, Peace, and Unity. Almost a century ago, one of the best baseball teams in the country featured long-haired, bushy-bearded cult members.
The major leagues wouldn't let them play Major League Baseball because you had to be clean-shaven, so the Negro Leagues invited them to play.
The day the House of David teamed up with Satchel Paige. Coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Simon & Schuster, presenting this message. Simon & Schuster, publisher of Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. This New York Times best-selling biography of Tiger Woods is sourced from years of reporting and more than 250 interviews, chronicling the life and career of the championship golfer, including his childhood, rise to fame, and success on the golf course and business world, his public downfall, and ongoing comeback. Tiger Woods is available in paperback, ebook, and as an audiobook.
We know sometimes you need a break from all of the negativity, but there are so many good things all around us. Kind World is a show about profound acts of kindness that help transform lives. New episodes every Tuesday. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jason Gay, and it's time for three stories you should know. As we all anticipated, the most exciting and controversial moment from the past week in sports came during the fourth inning of a Wednesday afternoon game between the Chicago White Sox and the Kansas City Royals.
Tim crushes this ball. He throws the bat. The ball goes flying. It is gone. 2-0 Sox.
That was Tim Anderson mashing a home run. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Julie DeCaro, sports writer and host at Chicago's 670 The Score via Skype, and by Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Jason. Thanks.
I'm starting with the bat flips. Bat flips, maybe you love them, maybe you hate them. Either way, the bats are flipping, and good old-fashioned, tradition-obsessed Pepperidge Farm Grandma's hard candy jar Major League Baseball still can't seem to figure out what to do with them. For those of you out there who haven't had the pleasure or outrage of witnessing one, a bat flip is when a batter hits a home run, preferably a no-doubt-about-it home run, and then chucks his bat skyward like a Roman candle in celebration. Some in baseball think this has gone too far. This week, Chicago's Tim Anderson ticked off the Kansas City Royals with his bat flip celebration, so the Royals retaliated by hitting him with a pitch in a later at-bat. Really? We're still doing this? It seems a little aggressive and short-sighted. At a time when baseball is desperate to inject a little fun into its sport, I'm not sure retaliation for bat flips is the way to go. Can't baseball players appreciate how a joyously flipped bat lifts all boats? I mean, bats?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, younger generations love the bat flips. They love players who show a ton of emotion. And I think we're also being remiss, you know, if we don't point out the fact that a lot of the people criticizing bat flips, it's coming from sort of the older establishment white baseball players. And a lot of times it's directed at players of color. And baseball's got to get this figured out, because the fact is that the NBA and the NFL have sort of embraced the drama. And baseball still has got the fun police out there talking about the fact that, oh, you showed me up, so now I've got to drill you. The response is completely disproportionate. Like, you hurt my feelings or you hurt my pride, so now I'm going to throw an incredibly dangerous object at your head at 95 miles an hour. It's completely ridiculous, and it's long past time for baseball to get over these stupid unwritten rules.
Yeah, precisely. I agree 100%. I think that what happens with these unwritten rules is you have this idea that the baseball guardians or whatever they want to call themselves are protecting a tradition, the tradition of baseball. But the tradition of baseball goes beyond the major leagues. Tradition of baseball includes the Negro Leagues, which were all about performance, including a team called the Indianapolis Clowns, who are literally like the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball. And so the idea that baseball is played one type of way and has these unwritten rules is really just another way to further marginalize and alienate large groups of people, particularly Latinx and Black players, from a game that they also have a large and long history to. I'm just so confounded by it. Like, if you don't want somebody to flip their bat, like, throw a better ball.
Also, Major League Baseball's still kind of in year zero of bat flipping. You look at the professional baseball overseas in a country like South Korea, the bat flip is like high art over there. They've been doing it for decades. All right, Amira Rose, you're up next.
Yeah, this week, Breonna Stewart, playing over in Russia in the EuroLeague Final Four Championship, came down in the second corner on the foot of Brittany Griner, and unfortunately, it resulted in her rupturing her right Achilles tendon. She successfully underwent surgery, but she will miss the entire WNBA season. This injury, though, points to a larger issue of the state of the WNBA, and it's a familiar discussion, but the very fact that she's over there to subsidize her WNBA salary, the fact that she plays year-long just to earn financial stability, is really, really atrocious. Let's just remember that she is the reigning league MVP, all-star, first-team all-star, and her base salary last year was $56,000, and it comes at an interesting time, because the WNBA players are renegotiating their collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah.
And so while her surgery will be covered, her medical costs will be covered, it really does underscore this issue where you have your best players. That game that she was playing in featured seven top WNBA players. You have your best players going overseas every single year.
Julie, your thoughts. Do you think this will become a point of contention as negotiations progress?
I hope it becomes a point of contention. I mean, it's ridiculous, and it's something we see across women's sports. I've talked to U.S. hockey team players who have talked about the fact that, you know, they work three jobs so that they can play for USA Hockey, and then they're expected to go out and compete with people from other parts of the world who are able to just train full time. And it's an issue in the way that we value women's sports in this country, and that it's undervalued significantly compared to men's sports. So it's really time for the NBA to put their money where their mouth is, infuse a lot more cash into the WNBA. And while it's unfortunate that Breonna Stewart's not going to be playing, I'm glad that this issue at least has come to the forefront and people are finally discussing it.
Yeah, Amira Rose, I can't help but think that were this a men's basketball player, say Steph Curry was playing in Russia during his NBA offseason, there would be a national outrage as to why this actually was happening. Whereas, as you point out, this has been par for the course for many, many years. Why doesn't the NBA, which I think of as being a progressive, very optics-obsessed league, commit itself more to doing the right thing with the Women's League?
Yeah, I think the NBA has certainly shown signs of investing in various ways, but they're very particular about how they invest. You'll hear even the commissioner say, oh, it's on the league to sell itself and they need to get eyeballs. And they do kind of the bare minimum. And like you said, like to engage in this optic of supporting the league. But the fact remains that there is a lot more that could be done.
All right, Julie, you're batting in the cleanup spot. Bat flip away.
Yeah, I'm going to backflip. So if you're like me and you grew up playing soccer in this country, you've been hearing for like 20 years that soccer is the fastest growing sport in America, and pretty soon it's going to be huge. And we're just waiting for it still to become huge in this country, right? Well, good news from MLS this week, which is that they're expanding from 24 teams to 30. They're also now going to seek training and compensation fees for players that wind up playing for foreign clubs. So that means that players like Christian Pulisic and DeAndre Yedlin, who were raised and invested in by American soccer clubs and then wind up going to play for big time clubs overseas, there's going to be some cash compensation, hopefully. I'm hoping that we're able to end or at least significantly cut back pay for play soccer, which is what soccer has largely become in this country. And it cuts out a huge portion of youth soccer players in America. I've seen really good kids in my own kids' soccer club that have wound up sort of getting financed out of the game because their parents couldn't afford the fees anymore. So hopefully, if we've got more money going into these clubs, that leaves more money for scholarships and more money for that clubs can charge lesser fees or even have kids come in free altogether who really deserve to be there and sort of get pay to play out of American soccer.
It starts very, very young, like younger even than I think that we realize. By halfway through elementary school, you can be tracked into good soccer development programs, or you're on Maple League teams or traveling teams that require a parent to drive you, a car to get you to, you know, a field 45 minutes away. And so I think investment in soccer in the United States in general has a lot of opportunities to not only help inclusion of the sport at a young level and see that sustain, but also it trickles back into the women's game as well. And so I think there's actually a great opportunity with this expansion to just push the boundaries of what we think soccer coverage looks like. With this expansion, it does point to the fact that there is an audience, there is development to be done and places to tap into, and I would like to see that continue.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear this discussed in a much more holistic ecosystem fashion than just the typical way we talk about expansion, which is, do these cities, will they put butts in seats? You know, clearly there's a bigger objective here. And do you think MLS is up to this, Julie?
I hope so. I mean, the first time I saw an Atlanta FC game, I was like, is this their first home opener? Because it's just the pageantry and the excitement. And people are like, no, it's like this pretty much every game. I mean, if you watch, if you've ever seen, you know, Seattle games, Portland games, LA Galaxy games, I mean, obviously there is a huge market in this country for soccer. We just got to change the way it's marketed. And hopefully they'll get this figured out soon.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and Julie DeCaro, sports writer and host at Chicago's 670 The Score. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jason.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
My darkest past can be a beacon of light for somebody else. I can say, hey, look what I've walked through. You can walk through this too.
Kind World, stories about how profound acts of kindness, big and small, can change lives.
Honestly, the most transformative thing was being treated like a person when I didn't even feel like I was a human.
Our new season starts April 16th with new episodes every Tuesday. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jason Gay. Next week on Only a Game, how chicken nuggets have helped Cleveland Cavaliers fans forget about King James. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Jason.
Charlie, I've been reading reports that a golfer named Tiger Woods won a golf tournament in Georgia over the weekend, and now the President of the United States wants to award him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Now, you can't possibly have any opinions about this matter, can you?
Well, first of all, it was really kind of a remarkable moment at Augusta. It was Tiger Woods winning a Masters the way a 40-year-old Tiger Woods would win a Masters. But as for the Presidential Medal of Freedom, I think Tiger could be very thankful the president isn't trying to sell it to him.
Of course, now the majors watch is back on. Tiger's at 15 majors. Only Jack Nicklaus with 18 has more. This felt dead and buried a few months ago. Can Tiger now tie or surpass Jack?
Well, no, I don't. I still don't think so. I don't think he's got four of those tournaments left in him. I'm less sure than I was before last weekend because he does seem to have taken the measure of Augusta, so he'll certainly play at least four more Masters. I just hope he like wins the Doral or something at this point. Let's watch him win a, you know, kind of run of the mill tournament first.
Phoenix Waste Management.
The John Deere Classic in Des Moines, Iowa.
Tampa Bay Lightning, winningest NHL club this season, swept in the opening round of the Stanley Cup playoffs by the immortal Columbus Blue Jackets. This marks the first time that's happened to a President's Cup team. Where do we place this, Charlie, on the list of all-time sports humiliations?
I don't think it's that big an upset. Columbus is pretty good. And John Tortorella is a terrific coach. And it became very plain early on that Tampa Bay wasn't ready to be a favorite. It wasn't so much they weren't ready to be in the playoffs. They weren't ready to be the number one seed.
Yeah.
As soon as the other team didn't fall down and just sort of let the Lightning roll over them, they had no plan B. If I were whoever plays Columbus in the next round, I would not take them easily. This is a very good hockey team.
Isn't this also hockey kind of being hockey? I know technically this is rare because you didn't have a President's Cup winning team getting bounced like this, but hockey's always surprising you.
Well, I mean, you've got all the other factors, the weird bounces off the boards, the hot goalie, as we say up here. You know, there are a number of variables in hockey that don't exist in other sports, but you can't attribute this to anything more than over those four games, the Columbus Blue Jackets being better than the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Duke sensation Zion Williamson has officially declared his intention to make himself available for the draft. Surprise, surprise. It's assumed he'll be the most hyped number one pick since LeBron James was a number one pick. Is Zion really this kind of transformative basketball figure? And how do we stop him from becoming a New York Knick?
Well, I don't know that there's any way to stop him from becoming a New York Knick unless we fix the lottery as the Knicks did many years ago. I don't know. I mean, I watched the guy all season. I watched him in person over the first weekend of the tournament. He impresses me, and this is not in any way insulting, as Charles Barkley or perhaps another step up to Karl Malone. I don't know that he's a transformative figure in the history of the game the way Michael Jordan was or the way Bill Russell was. I didn't see any indication of that, no. But he's certainly going to be the beneficiary of the Phil Knight marketing behemoth, even though, you know, Nike's shoe blew up on him and almost cost him the season. you know, he's certainly going to be the beneficiary of the most hype in this year's draft.
I'm just glad I can go back to hating Duke. I liked Zion so much that I was liking Duke, and this was very strange.
Yeah, they were a pretty good bunch this year. RJ Barrett was an interesting guy. They were a hard team to dislike, but maybe that's the secret. Maybe Coach K has found the secret of getting people not to hate Duke, which is to run the players in and out so fast you don't get a chance to hate them.
Finally, Charlie, newly retired Patriot Rob Gronkowski has added to his legend this week when his club revealed that the Gronk had dented the team's most recent Super Bowl trophy. He used the Lombardi as a baseball bat during a visit to Fenway Park. Now, it's a long list, Charlie, but is this the most Gronk story of them all?
I think, no, it would have been the most Gronk story if he'd used his head as the bat. But it is very Gronk. There is definite Gronkitude in this entire episode. The Gronkosity of using it for a bat. First of all, how do you swing the thing? It looks like it would be unwieldy.
My favorite part of it was I think he squared to bunt.
He did.
I don't think it was actually a full swing.
He did, and he still dented it. So good for you, Gronk. Now he doesn't have to play football. He can be Gronk full time. He can be just a Gronk in the world.
The Patriots are saying they're not going to take the dent out of the trophy. Is there a case to take it out?
No, absolutely not. It's that trophy's, you know, permanent Gronkosity. You don't want to fix that.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Jason.
Let's be real for a second. Some shows, they need to rely on torture and nudity and dragons to hold your attention. Only a Game doesn't. We just find great stories about real people. Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast to make sure you catch all the great stories every week. This next story involves the greatest Negro Leagues pitcher of all time.
His catchers actually had to cushion their gloves with a beefsteak.
A religious cult that brought thousands of people to the American Midwest.
They had an empire. They really had like a Roman empire in Michigan.
And a mystery that took 4.5 decades to solve. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Phil Lease can't remember exactly when he first learned about the game his father caught for Satchel Paige. It was the 60s, and Phil was a kid living in Hamilton Dome, Wyoming.
Smaller than a small town, it's a classic salt dome oil field about 25 miles west of Thermopolis. And my dad was a pumper.
Phil loved baseball. He'd study the box scores in the Casper Star Tribune and imagine what must have happened on the field.
You know, if a player only had 2 at-bats, I figured, they must have pulled him or he had an injury or something.
But in his parents' basement, underneath the stairs, Phil found something that did even more to ignite his imagination.
There's a pair of cleats and some old flat baseball gloves, but there's also this jersey. And the jersey said, House of David. Every time we had a softball game, I would drag out that jersey and I'd wear it proudly. It was green in color and it had maybe 2-inch block white letters. There's no numbers on the back. Heavyweight cotton with half sleeves fit me perfectly to my wrists when I was 8 or 9 years old.
It wasn't the soft fabric or those big white letters that made the jersey special. It was the story Phil's dad would tell about the one and only game he played for the House of David, the day he caught for Satchel Paige. Yes, that Satchel Paige. Paige spent most of his career in the Negro Leagues, not signing his rookie MLB contract until the age of 42. He kept his own records and made the extraordinary claim that he pitched 100 no-hitters over his career. On the other hand, Phil's dad, George, was an amateur who played for a town team. George Lease died when Phil was just 17, and Phil never got the chance to ask his dad for details, like when or where the game was played, or why George subbed in for Paige's regular catcher, Cy Perkins.
He had a little spare on details, to be sure, but he did always point out the fact that Satchel Paige threw with incredible velocity and that his hand had puffed up. You know, it had swollen about an inch thicker than its normal size.
George also told his sons about his teammates from the House of David. They had long, bushy beards and hair that went down past their shoulder blades.
But there was never any more details until much, much later, 2009 to be exact.
But before we get to that, we need to meet another young boy in another small town. Chris Siriano grew up in Benton Harbor, Michigan. And when he was young, his parents took him to a place called the House of David Amusement Park.
It was such a cool experience to go there on a Sunday after church and walk up to the big train depot where you got an ice cream cone and probably on a waffle cone, which they invented. You had to board the train to get back into the amusement park, which is about a half a mile in.
Did you have any idea that there was this strange religion attached to all of this?
I had no clue.
After Chris came home from college with a degree in history, he thought it might be fun to tackle a local research project. That's when he first learned about the people behind that amusement park.
The House of David was formed by Benjamin and Mary Purnell. They were from Kentucky, Paducah, Kentucky, and they traveled the Midwest as itinerant preachers in the 1890s in a covered wagon. He taught that he was the brother to Christ and the Son of God and the Messiah.
When Benjamin and Mary arrived in Benton Harbor in the fall of 1902, they met up with two wealthy businessmen named Louis and Albert Bosch. And as it turned out, the Bosch brothers were searching for the Messiah.
So they agreed to join his cause. They donated over $400,000 in cash, which is millions, probably tens of millions today.
Benjamin preached that his presence signaled the end of days, but he said his followers would never die. They'd live in paradise on earth.
In exchange for that promise, you give them everything you own.
Soon, thousands of new followers started arriving from all over the world. They'd turn over their belongings, and Benjamin Purnell would create for them the perfect new job. And that's how he ended up starting a baseball team.
I think he just decided that there was a whole lot of teenage boys and guys in their early 20s with a whole lot of pent-up energy because they also lived a celibate society. They couldn't have sex. And so Benjamin thought that he should start a baseball team.
With very little to distract them from learning the game, the House of David baseball team, formed around 1914, got very good very quickly. In just a few years, they were being invited to play baseball all over North America. And this is where we get back to Phil Leese and the year 2009, because that's when Phil heard a radio interview about one of those invitations the House of David received. By then, Phil was living in Colorado.
Well, I was commuting home. At the time, I worked up in Broomfield, and I was driving on some pretty, you know, bad traffic back to South Denver. And listening to my local NPR affiliate.
You're tuned to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner.
And they had an interview with Larry Tye.
Tye is the author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Larry, thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
I'd like you to
So, of course, the name Satchel Paige caught my interest, and I was listening attentively. And then Larry Tye began speaking of a tournament in Denver.
The Denver post-tournament had begun.
And in 1934, this was a watershed year for the tournament because it was the first time that Negro leagues were invited to play on a competitive basis, not just as an exhibition team.
Reached the first and the highest profile interracial face-off maybe ever in the world, in the baseball world.
The Negro leagues were represented by the Kansas City Monarchs, often remembered as Satchel Paige's team. But as Phil listened, he learned that Paige didn't pitch for the Monarchs in that tournament.
The idea that he was coming in with a team from this group called the House of David.
All of a sudden, really then, for me, everything just sprang back into life because in a single sentence, I had Satchel Paige, House of David, and Denver. My father was a resident of Georgetown, Colorado, just up the hill.
Phil immediately went out and bought Larry Tye's book. He hoped it would lead him to more details about that game his father caught for Satchel Paige, maybe even the box score. But there's an even bigger mystery here. How did the greatest Negro League pitcher of all time end up on the mound for a religious cult from Michigan? Well, the short answer is that the House of David signed a lot of famous ball players to short-term contracts. Babe Ruth even played for them in a game or two. For the longer answer, we need to go back to Chris Siriano. Chris has spent the past 30 years researching the House of David, interviewing members and collecting artifacts. He runs his own museum, the House of David Baseball Museum. Chris says the team was good enough to play in the major leagues, but
part of their belief was that they could never shave or cut their hair. The major leagues wouldn't let them play Major League Baseball because you had to be clean shaven. So the Negro Leagues invited them to play with them because they couldn't play in the major leagues because they were black. So they teamed up together and they traveled the country in the late 1920s all the way through roughly 1940.
And the team that the House of David would most often travel with was the Kansas City Monarchs. There's this one story Chris loves to tell about those days. He heard it from Lloyd Dallagher, a House of David member who played from 1926 through 1940.
They would travel in two buses. He said when we only pulled into town with one bus.
The other bus, Lloyd said, would wait while Lloyd, his father, and another House of David player marched into the baseball manager's office and said,
Mr. Manager, we're so happy to be here in your town and we're excited and you're going to love us, but here's the deal, sir.
The men would explain that before they played their game that day, the Kansas City Monarchs were going to take the field.
Never before have you even allowed them into your stadium, much less your town. But sir, they're going to put on a show, and after that, we're going to play. And then after the games, they're going to come to the restaurant with us that we always go to, and we've booked rooms in the hotel that we always stay at. And if you can't make all that happen, sir, the next town pastures is on rain check. So it's fine if you can't make all this happen. We're just going to leave and keep going. The room would get silent. Sometimes these managers would throw things. They'd punch the wall or they'd scream at us or, you know, they'd leave the room and slam the door. And he said, we'd just stand there.
As Lloyd told Chris, every time the baseball manager would come back and say that the Monarchs would be allowed to play, but that the House of David should never expect to be invited back again.
But he said, guess what, Chris? When the Kansas City Monarchs took the field and started playing baseball, their fans were amazed and they laughed and they cheered. And at the end of the game, there would be a huge standing ovation for how awesome these Monarchs were. And he said, guess what, Chris? Next year, they invited us both back.
So while it might seem strange that Satchel Paige was on the mound for the House of David when they beat the Kansas City Monarchs in the championship game of that 1934 Denver Post tournament, these two teams had a long history of working together to inspire baseball fans. But back to our other mystery. Phil Lease had spent 45 years wondering when and where his father might have caught for Satchel Paige. Could this tournament be the answer? Phil's research led him to the microfilm archives at his local library.
You know, I went through several spools of microfilm. Eventually, though, I found the actual edition of the paper that had the box score of the game that my dad caught.
What was it like to see his name there?
Oh my gosh, I was just overjoyed. I took cell phone pictures of it. I printed out some blurry copy of it. I couldn't get over the fact that I'd actually found the object of a search that had started essentially in 1964.
Phil found evidence that suggests Cy Perkins was a last-minute scratch, but nothing else that would explain why his father played for the House of David that day. All he could find was a box score and a few lines of copy about the 17 strikeouts Paige threw that night. But remember, Phil has a lot of experience reading a box score and imagining a baseball game.
It would have been a nice warm evening in August. I saw that in the newspaper weather. It was being played at 8:30 at night at Merchants Park, which means they were under the lights. And I know that stadium lights were this harsh, glinting kind of a blue light. So I imagine what that must have been like. There were 6,000 people in the stands, and my dad would have clipped on the shin guards, chest protector, and pulled on the mask, and he would have taken a few warm-up pitches for Satchel Paige. And I can just imagine how that would have popped in his glove and how it would have stung. Dad was 0 for 4 that night hitting. I'm sure his left hand was swollen so badly he probably felt he was swinging the bat with one hand.
Phil wrote down the story of Satchel Paige, the House of David, and the day George Lease played in a game of real historical significance. He bound it into a book and presented it to his family.
And I just wanted them to have a connection to their father, their grandfather, and to a time and a place in a baseball game. That was a magical moment.
But while the number of people connected to George Lease's story grows with every new generation, the same can't be said of Benjamin Purnell's followers. Purnell forbade them from procreating and promised that they'd never die. When Chris Siriano met them, the last remaining House of David ballplayers were in their 80s and 90s.
They loved, loved, loved their lives. They laughed. I swear they laughed with like a belly laugh, like my grandkids do. And they died and died and died and died and died, and now they're all gone.
That story came from Only a Game's Karen Given. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallet, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Jason Gay. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.